The wild presidential campaign of 2016 continues as we sift through yesterday's results on the Republican side in Nevada. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with NPR political reporter Mara Liasson. She's covered presidential politics for more than 20 years. Is this campaign as unpredictable as it seems? Is the success of Donald Trump unprecedented? Plus, both Democrats and Republicans are extremely focused on voter turnout and getting their supporters to the polls and their ballots to the right places to get counted. How real is voter suppression? How real is voter fraud? I'll talk with Michael Waldman about those issues and his new book, The Right to Vote. Also, the fight continues between Apple and the federal government over whether the company should help find a way to tap into the phone of one of the San Bernardino shooters. I'll talk with longtime tech writer Dan Gilmore about the issues and how the situation may play out. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, the 2016 presidential campaign has been called unprecedented, unpredictable, and surprising. That's mostly been because of businessman Donald Trump's presence at the top of most polls on the Republican side. I'll talk with NPR's Mara Liasson about Trump and the issues that voters are most focused on and concerned about. Plus, many Republicans and Democrats have found themselves on different sides when it comes to voter fraud versus voter suppression. I'll talk with Michael Waldman of the Brennan Center about the reality of the situation and his new book, The Fight to Vote. And we'll talk to one of the longtime members of the band The Mavericks. The group was up for a couple of Grammys earlier this month, and they'll be in the Valley this weekend. We start today's program by taking a deeper look at the conflict between Apple and the federal government. The public fight began when the FBI called on Apple to circumvent iPhone security so the government could look inside the device that was owned by one of the San Bernardino shooters. That incident involved 14 deaths. In prior situations, Apple has argued the government could, quote, push the law to a new frontier and force the company to change its products. To learn more, I'm joined by Dan Gilmore. He's a longtime technology writer and columnist and director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at ASU's Cronkite School. Dan, welcome.
Good to be with you.
So, Dan, what is the government actually asking Apple to do, and what is the government saying it wants Apple to do? For a lot of people, that seems like different stuff right there.
Well, a lot of the confusion is because of some poor journalism that people are seeing. The government is not exactly asking Apple to unlock the phone. It's asking Apple to essentially replace the current operating system with a revised operating system that would let the government make repeated quick attempts to guess the password. Right now, the device has settings so that after 10 guesses, it will just erase everything and take longer each time. So it would take a long time, and it's very unlikely that they would do it. So they're asking for essentially a replacement of the operating system and for Apple to sign it like a digital signature so that the phone will agree to install the new operating system. It's pretty complicated.
So based on what you're saying about the media coverage, has it been framed as an either-or situation? We either have privacy or we have security, and we can't have both.
From my perspective, and I do have a bias on this one, which is this is not about privacy versus security. This is about security versus security. It's in other ways. That Apple makes, in my view, a very good case that doing this would undermine in the future users' trust, and for very good reasons, in the safety of what they were using. And the government is saying, well, that's worth it. And I think that that's what has to be decided, whether we want the government to be able to require technology companies to undermine the security that they're building into their products. And security experts, it's very likely that other people will be able to hack the devices and software as well.
Dan, what are other major tech leaders and companies saying about this? We heard from Bill Gates, I guess, just yesterday, and he seemed to be on the opposite side of many other tech leaders.
He did. He appeared to say, at least he was quoted as saying, that they should just do what the FBI wants. From another story I saw, he looks like he was trying to walk that back a little bit, but I think you can safely say he's on the side of government on this particular one. Google CEO came out with kind of a sort of endorsement of Apple's position. Likewise, Facebook, the guy who started WhatsApp was very strong in support of Apple on it. I would think that over time, the tech industry would fall more behind Apple than not.
So is Gates off on his own island somewhere? Were you bothered by the fact that he decided to side? Did he give any logical reasons for that, why he sided with the government?
Well, I think he's essentially saying it's worth it. And it's fairly well known that Microsoft has been a cooperator with government for a long time in its own software and technology. I'm speaking my own views on. I'm personally bothered that they would do that. But when companies have immense contracts with the government, that may influence them in some way. And I should point out that Gates is no longer CEO at Microsoft, though he is chairman.
Can I use the phrase Pandora's box, even though that's a pat phrase? Is there the risk that if, in fact, Apple is forced to do this, that it opens up a dangerous Pandora's box for the immediate future?
I think, in my view, yes, it does. But I think the government will argue that technology opened a Pandora's box for them because in some very limited ways, it's harder for them to decode certain conversations. The government's never had so many tools available, by the way, as it does now to track and keep an eye on people. I mean, my goodness, they can do anything with what we have, and the NSA, who knows what they've got. But there is reason for some in government to say, well, this is going to become more problematic. We're going to have more trouble listening to everything we want to listen to. And there's some fairness to that. Again, if we undermine security in one area, we're likely to undermine it quite widely. And that's the real issue, whether we want to have strong security for everyone or not.
And Dan, this is asking a lot, but as technology advances dramatically, could we see a time where if one individual says, yes, I believe that the threat and the worry about terrorism is enough that, yes, I will buy a phone that does have a backdoor of some sort, and another person might say, I don't want that, so they can't. Is it possibly we'll have sort of an a la carte situation where you can decide whether your phone has extra security or not?
Well, we're moving that way. There are some phones available now on the market that are quite hardened against intrusion, and I think we're going to see more of that. We're going to see more demand on the part of customers for things like this. And I would caution someone who would buy a phone saying, well, I'm willing for the government to backdoor into my phone, to keep in mind that if there's a backdoor in the software and the hardware, it will be discovered and used by people that person might not want to be inside of the device or network. So while any one of us may not be at particular risk, we are collectively more so if we weaken our technology.
Finally, Dan, how do you think this is going to turn out?
My mind reading skills are really weak. I hope that it turns out that Apple wins the immediate case, but this is not over. This is going to be a pitched battle because this is one of those times when we're looking at a a situation where it becomes quite binary. It's either yes, there's strong security, or no. And that's going to be fought out in Congress, I would imagine. And again, I hope that we opt as a country for a strong security. And I should point out that the former head of the National Security Agency has, now that he's not in that job anymore, said, yes, we have to preserve strong security because the risks are too high if we don't.
Dan Gilmore, longtime technology writer and columnist and director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at ASU's Cronkite School. Dan, thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Dan was joining us from Spain. You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Last night, Nevada's Republican caucus voters followed the lead of primary voters in New Hampshire and South Carolina and handed Donald Trump another victory. Marco Rubio was a distant second. Ted Cruz was even further back in third. With me for a few minutes to talk about Nevada and Arizona's upcoming presidential preference election is political strategist Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Barrett, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Boy, I'm only joining you from the West Valley.
Well, your connection's not that great either, Bear, but thanks anyway for the time. So how do last night's Nevada numbers, what do they tell you about what the race is shaping up?
Well, they tell me that what happens in Vegas will spread to the rest of the country. You know, in Arizona, we have seen Donald Trump in the mid to high 30s in several different polls that have come out in the last few months. And I think that is going to hold. He got in the mid-40s yesterday. I think he will get a little bit of a boost for everyone out there. Remember, today starts early voting. Ballots will go out in Arizona to people who are on the permanent early voting list. So you should be getting your ballots very soon if you are a Democrat or a Republican.
So how similar or different are Nevada Republicans and Arizona Republicans? I mean, are we seeing a situation where, based on what Nevada caucus voters did last night, we should expect a similar run here in Arizona? I know we're, as you said, several weeks away, but with early voting starting, I wonder if there are similar characteristics these voters share.
You know, absolutely. We, both Arizona and Nevada, we both share more of a libertarian streak in our conservativeness. You know, we are Republicans, but we are also libertarians at heart. So I do think that Nevada Republicans and Arizona Republicans are very similar. We both have a bit of an anti-federal government streak in us. We have to work with the federal government because the federal government has so much land in both here and in Nevada. So I actually think that we are similar, and I think we're going to see some similar results. You know, Rubio is moving up in the polls. Again, over the last couple months, you know, he's gaining some traction. People like former Senator John Kyle and current Senator Jeff Flake have come out and endorsed him. He's certainly getting the establishment vote. But as we saw in Nevada yesterday, establishment means little. People are not as interested in the establishment out here in the West.
What about folks who are independents in Arizona who decided that they would register with one party or the other? Let's say in this case, registering with the Republicans, can they have some sort of impact? How would independents potentially lean on this? And I guess especially with Jeb Bush out and John Kasich heading that way, it looks like they're going to have basically three choices.
Yeah, you know, it took some effort. I was registered until 3 days ago as an independent. And I changed my registration to a Republican so that I can vote in the primary. I'm still actually undecided because I do want to see how the race shakes out before, you know, Super Tuesday is going to happen. So will we see some movement among the candidates? But again, early voting does start today. So you will see people actually start turning in their ballots, and the excited people for Trump or the excited people for Rubio or for Cruz are probably, you know, get those ballots and turn them in, and they're going to be very vocal on social media and places like that. So I don't know that a lot of independents changed their registration and will be active. I think that's going to be an interesting thing to see the final numbers how many independents actually decided to go either Democrat or Republican. Because unlike our state primaries, the parties say you must be a Republican or a Democrat to vote in the presidential preference election.
Barrett, final question. Considering we expect Senator Clinton to win the Democratic nomination, and though she's different from her husband, President Clinton did carry Arizona at one point, any of these Republican candidates look like someone that would be a loser in Arizona in the general?
Well, I don't know. The Republicans could nominate someone that would bring Arizona into play. I don't know that automatic loss for any Republican here in Arizona. Yes, Bill Clinton won here in 1996. That was a long time ago. His popularity is very high. Hillary Clinton is a whole other candidate. She has had a lot of negatives, a lot of people with disdain for her and some of her actions. Her trust factor is very low. So that is going to drag her down. That being said, again, Bill Clinton is very popular. He could come here and campaign, but it's all going to depend on who the nominee is. Donald Trump, again, is in the mid to high 30s here. Is that his ceiling? Everyone talks about his ceiling. Is that his ceiling? You know, I think we're going to have to wait and see whether he can attract other people than his core supporters.
Political strategist Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Barrett, thanks.
Hey, thank you, Steve. Bye-bye.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk more about the 2016 campaign with NPR reporter Mara Liasson. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Sun Health Senior Living, a nonprofit provider of independent living retirement communities with upscale dining, resort-style amenities, and numerous residence options. More at sunhealthretirement.org.
This is Here and Now on 91.5 FM. We're also streaming live at kjzz.org, and you can download our mobile app. Taking a quick look at Valley traffic right now on I-17 southbound, there's still a report of a crash at 16th Street. Well, it's mostly sunny across the state at this hour, 40 degrees in Flagstaff, 48 in Prescott. It's 64 in Casa Grande, 63 in Tucson, and 70 degrees in Yuma. Become a KJZZ business member and get connected with an audience that values public radio for balanced, factual information. Help keep this community resource strong with a philanthropic donation to the KJZZ Business Member Program. You can learn more at businessmember.kjzz.org or call 480-774-8274. It's mostly sunny and 68 degrees in Phoenix at 1124.
The 2016 presidential campaign has been called unprecedented, unpredictable, and surprising. That's mostly been because of businessman Donald Trump's presence at the top of most polls on the Republican side. And it's been firmed up by Trump's recent primary victories. NPR's Mara Liasson has covered presidential campaigns since 1992. She'll be in the Valley on Thursday for a presentation called A Citizen's Guide to the 2016 Election as a part of Barrett the Honors College at ASU. And she joins me now to talk about 2016. Mara, have you seen anything like the phenomenon that is Donald Trump in all the campaigns you've covered over the years?
Never, never. There's nothing to compare this to. Everybody's compasses are off, and every bit of conventional wisdom has been proved wrong this year. So it's an extraordinary, phenomenal election.
So as many people as you talk to, as much reporting as you've done, as much experience as you have, how come no one saw this train coming?
Well, that's a really good question. I was one of the many, many people that said the day Trump announced this will be his best day. Ha ha, I was wrong. Yeah. You can see where he came from, but it was hard to predict. In other words, Donald Trump is doing a mind meld with a big chunk of the Republican primary electorate. These are people who feel that they're angry at the political establishment in Washington. They're angry at their own Republican leadership, who, even though they have the House and the Senate, can't seem to stop President Obama's agenda. They're angry at President Obama. They're angry at the media. They haven't had a raise in, 15 years. We've had income stagnation. They look around the world. The world looks like it's on fire, and the U.S. can't seem to do much about it except for get involved in endless feudal wars. There's a lot of reasons for people to feel the way they do, and along comes Donald Trump with this message that he'll make America great again, and it sounds pretty good. I think he's squarely within the tradition of American populism, you know, whether it's Huey Long or Ross Perot or George Wallace, who kind of combined nativism with economic grievance. On the other hand, one of the reasons he's lasted so long and is doing so well is that, unlike previous Republican primaries, it's the moderate establishment vote that's split, and he's been able to more or less consolidate the conservative kind of grassroots insurgent anti-establishment vote. I mean, that usually doesn't happen. Usually the Republican establishment coalesces around one candidate like Mitt Romney, and they certainly are trying to do now around Marco Rubio, but it's a little late.
Okay, so you do think it is a little late then? So this is true.
Okay. Let's put it this way. It's late. Whether it's too late, I don't know. The states coming up on March 1st, he's got big leads in a lot of them, in most of them. So the question for Marco Rubio is, where is he going to win? What state is he going to win? And how is he going to convince all the other candidates to drop out?
So,
there's still John Kasich, there's still Ben Carson, even if he's not much of a factor, and there's Ted Cruz.
So this is a wonky question for you. Is there any reason, when we see the results that we've seen so far, any reason to think that there will be more of a push to change the primary and the caucus schedule? Because people for years have said Iowa and New Hampshire don't really reflect the broader electorate, and then even South Carolina, obviously much more diverse area, but not necessarily on the Republican side. Is this making it so it's going to be harder to find that establishment candidate, or is Trump just a one-off?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when this is all over and we don't know how it's going to end, the Republican Party will ask itself these questions. And after they asked themselves similar questions last time, and they tried to tweak the primary schedule, tweak the debate schedule so that their nominee could wrap it up a little earlier. They made sure their convention was earlier. But I think that for the Republican establishment, we don't know what the Republican establishment will look like, if it'll even exist after all this is over. But I don't know if it's a matter of changing the primary schedules. I don't think that Donald Trump is a creation of Iowa and New Hampshire. I mean, you look at all the states, he's got big leads, especially in the South. So I think the only reform that I could think of, since you're asking me this question, is, I suppose, if Donald Trump was nominated and he lost really big, the Republicans could do what the Democrats did after McGovern, which is create this special class of delegates called superdelegates, and it's a way to give the establishment a bit of a thumb on the scale to prevent in the Democratic Party, a far left grassroots supported candidate that couldn't win the general election from being nominated.
Now,
that's something the Democrats did, but that's really making a lot of assumptions.
Well, I'm just throwing stuff against the wall here, because I'm thinking less in terms of it created Trump as opposed to the fact that maybe did it hurt Rubio and Bush, for example, so they were not as strong against Trump. Because if there had been an Ohio, a Michigan early up front, would that have given them more of the industrialized states, the more conventional folks?
I don't really know, except for that Trump has a big lead in Ohio. He's polling better than John Kasich. And the Midwest, the industrial area where there are a lot of blue-collar Republicans, non-college-educated white males who are Trump's base, even though he wins with a much broader coalition than just those voters, I don't know why that would have necessarily given the establishment candidates a head start or a bigger chance. Okay. Those are great states for him. You know, the kind of blue-collar, non-college-educated Republican primary voter, which is Trump's base, although, like I said, he has a much broader coalition than that, those are voters that the Republican Party has wooed successfully for decades with social issues, whether it was gay marriage, school prayer, crime, welfare, abortion, you name it. But they didn't have an economic program for those voters, and those voters feel that they've been left behind and Washington doesn't listen to them, and along comes Donald Trump with a program that doesn't resemble anything we know of as Republican or conservative. He's against free trade. He's anti-immigration. He doesn't want to reform entitlements. He wants to tax hedge fund managers. It's hard to really – he's a populist. He's not a Republican or a conservative.
I'm asking you to jump ahead a little bit. Several months, let's say, we're past, and this doesn't even matter as to who the nominee for the Republicans or the Democrats would be, how much is fear going to dominate what's going on, whether it's the fear of getting a raise at work, losing a job, or even something like the fight between Apple and the federal government, terrorism versus privacy?
Well, I think the mood of the electorate this year is fearful and angry and anxious, and there's reason to be fearful. I mean, we've had a terrorist attack on our soil, and there's a lot of reason to be afraid. And generally, presidential elections are emotional things, and Democrats will want to make their voters afraid of what will happen if the Republicans are elected, and vice versa. I think that will be, you know, a big factor this year. This isn't a happy, contented, prosperous, peaceful time.
Let me finish with this then. How many people do you think, is there a higher percentage of people now who are paying attention because of the fight we're hearing about in the fight to replace Justice Scalia?
I think that, yes. I think that the Scalia's death and the fact that the opening on the Supreme Court is an opening that would change the balance of power. In other words, up until now, President Obama has been able to replace liberal retiring justices with another liberal. It hasn't changed the balance of power. But to replace Scalia, for Obama to replace Scalia, it would. So I think that Supreme Court vacancies usually are the kind of thing that only activists pay attention to, and generally it's been Republican activists because they're the ones that are feel betrayed by this court, even though it's a conservative court. They don't like the rulings on the ACA, the Obamacare, or gay marriage. So, yes, I think that the Scalia death makes the Supreme Court much more of an issue. It illustrates how high the stakes are in the fall, and I do think it'll get more people energized about the election. I don't know if it in and of itself will increase turnout. But for Democrats, up until now, a conservative majority court, which we've had for 50 years, was something they just had to live with. Now they don't.
So,
but theoretically, if they get a Democrat in the White House.
Yeah. I mean, do you think we'll see, obviously, there's so much money for campaign ads. Do you think we will see ads specifically lined up with who's going to replace the next Supreme Court justice kind of thing?
Well, I think that you've already seen ads. In other words, a pro Rubio super PAC is running an ad where they mention the Supreme Court. You know, they talk about all the things that are at stake, including the Supreme Court, and it's an attack ad against Trump and Cruz. If Obama nominates someone and that person doesn't get a hearing, which sounds like what the Republican strategy is going to be in the Senate. Mitch McConnell has reaffirmed that, the Senate Majority Leader. Then I think you could see ads around that person. If that person is highly qualified, broadly acceptable, and history-making, which I think are the three things that Obama's looking for, then it could be a real factor. I mean, for instance, if it was Loretta Lynch, you know, an African-American woman, I suppose you could see ads about her, and it could become a real issue in the African-American community, but we don't know who he's going to nominate.
NPR political reporter Mara Liasson, who's covered presidential campaigns since 1992, she'll be in the Valley tomorrow for a presentation called A Citizen's Guide to the 2016 Election as part of Barrett, the Honors College at ASU.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Democrats and Republicans will be working hard in the fall to get out the vote efforts. Turnout is vitally important to win very close elections, and both parties understand that. But there have been allegations of voter fraud from one side of the aisle, while the other focuses on voter suppression. In his new book, The Fight to Vote, Michael Waldman writes about some of those topics and many others. He's the president of the Brennan Center for Justice, and he joins me now. Michael, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So how at odds are the two major parties when it comes to making it easier for people to vote? Is one side trying to and the other side is not, or is that simplifying things?
It's simplifying things, but not by all that much at this precise moment. That happens to be kind of a snapshot of where things stand right now. It's been the case that in 19 states across the country, where Republicans mostly took control in 2011, have passed new laws to make it harder to vote. But in fact, it's the case that all throughout American history, there's been a fight over that very issue. It's always been at the center of our politics. It's actually been a robust and rowdy and partisan debate. And at every point where someone's pushing to expand the ranks of who has a say, just as often someone else, maybe who has something to lose, is pushing back in the other side. And sometimes it's been the Democrats and sometimes it's been the Republicans. There are obviously some issues where there's still agreement, and there's some issues where both parties tend to get their hand in, such as gerrymandering. I think both parties do it whenever they can. That's not to assign blame. But right now, there's a sharper partisan divide on this issue than there has been in a long time.
I want to come back to the phrase you just used, robust, rowdy, and partisan. Should we expect that from our politicians, but should we also expect honesty and fairness when it comes to this? You know, in particular, Arizona's had an issue when it comes to whether people should have to prove their citizenship at the polls in order to vote. And to many people, that sounds like an effort to block out people who perhaps don't speak English well.
Well, and it really, that particular issue, and the organization I lead, the Brennan Center for Justice, has been involved in that. Proof of citizenship is one of the most restrictive things that there can be. In other words, we talk about voter ID, and I'm actually for voter ID as a concept. I want to make sure that it's not requiring IDs that lots of people don't have. But the proof of citizenship is actually something a lot of people just don't have, including people who are citizens, who've been voting for a long time. Most Americans don't have a passport. It can actually be hard to or expensive to get your birth certificate. And I think that there's no question that that particular idea hits the Hispanic community hardest and people who don't speak English and recent immigrants. I think we can hope that people will only act in the disinterested public good, but 240 years of history teaches us that's not always the case. And it's an interesting thing. James Madison, when you go back and look at the founders, they didn't really think about voting rights quite the way we did. Only white men who owned property in those days could vote. And they didn't put anything really about who could vote in the Constitution. They wanted to leave it to the states. But what they did put in was something Madison insisted on. He really thought state legislatures could be up to no good and could pass laws to make it harder for their opponents to vote. It's called the Elections Clause. And he said there's no end to the mischief that people could come up with. That's the kind of thing that we see, and I guess I would say that the proof of citizenship falls into that category.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few minutes left with Michael Waldman. He's the author of the new book, The Fight to Vote. He's also president of the Brennan Center for Justice. Michael, how significant a problem is voter fraud? Should we be legitimately concerned about it? Is that, again, sort of a partisan issue sometimes as it relates to how many examples there really are?
Well, we should always be concerned about it, but we should be aware of how it really unfolds. When you look at the whole history of the country and the whole history of the way we run elections, there's been plenty of abuses and plenty of misconduct and plenty of ballot boxes stuffed. But it's almost always done by politicians. Senators have wanted to stuff the politicians have wanted to stuff the ballot box, you know, since senators wore togas long ago. But it's not ordinary people usually who walk in and do it. And a lot of these studies that people have done, all the authoritative estimates show that you are more likely to be killed by lightning than to commit in-person voter impersonation, which is the only kind of fraud that voter ID laws block. So I think we need to be careful. I think there are all kinds of ways to improve the security of elections and improve the integrity of elections that don't disenfranchise people. And when you look back at the whole history, and this book tries to draw some of the story out of how people have had to fight for the right to vote, from first white working men without property won the white right to vote, and then the right to vote was extended to the former slaves in the 15th Amendment, but it was taken away by repression in the South. There was even a real crackdown on voting in the North in the late 1800s by immigrants, by Catholic immigrants mostly from Europe, who were seen as probably committing fraud. That's at least how the old-time Americans saw it. And they made it much harder for them to vote. But then over the course of the 20th century, we had elections for senators. We had women win the right to vote in a very creative and little-remembered campaign. And the Civil Rights Movement won the greatest victory of all, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. These fights have gone on over and over and over again, and we just shouldn't be surprised that they're going to continue. It's a struggle for who we are and how do we live up to our ideals, and that's not something that's ever going to be finished.
Well, Michael, let's wrap up this way. Considering what you said about history and how much the book covers, do you think we're close to a tipping point on whether more people will be able to vote? And how important a moment in time could this be, in part because of changing demographics, in part just we continue to be a growing diverse country?
You've hit the nail on the head. I there have been other times in the country's history where we've moved forward, where we've expanded the circle of democracy, but there have been times when we've moved backwards. I have been worried and am worried that we're at a potential tipping point right now, where we've had not only new restrictions on voting, but a massive change in the way campaigns are financed, thanks to the Supreme Court, thanks to the Citizens United decision and other cases like that, so that a handful of very wealthy mega donors is dominating so much of the financing, especially below the presidential level, in governorships and Congress. But I also think that there's greater attention to this issue and greater focus on the state of democracy than there's been in a long time. And there are positive breakthroughs and developments that are happening all over the country. Arizona has really been a pioneer. For example, last June, the United States Supreme Court upheld Arizona's nonpartisan redistricting commission, which is a model for the country. California has now copied it. Ohio has just enacted something similar. There's a movement all over the country to try to end the partisan gerrymandering following the model of Arizona. And even on voting, more states lately have been improving voting than making it worse. The key thing is automatic voter registration. If we had a change in the paradigm, a change in the way we do this, so that the government keeps the list and automatically registers everyone who's eligible, it would add tens of millions of people to the rolls, and it would curb the potential for fraud. And that is now moving forward in California, in Oregon. There's a good chance it's going to pass in Illinois, and I know that folks in Arizona are talking about this as well, maybe bringing it to the public. So there's some exciting and positive developments, or we could go backwards. And this crazy election should remind us of how important this all is.
Michael Waldman's new book is The Fight to Vote. He's also the president of the Brennan Center for Justice. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll look at eating disorders. We'll also meet one of the members of the band The Mavericks. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Art Museum, presenting 26 rare drawings of Renaissance master Michelangelo, on loan from the Casa Buonarroti in Florence, Italy, and seen for the first time in Arizona. Now on view through March 27th. phxart.org for details.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. Well, sunny and warm today for the valley, a high near 78 degrees, and that warming trend is going to continue for the next couple of days at least. Highs tomorrow, 84 and 86 on Friday. NPR's Here and Now is coming up at 12 today when a TV channel sponsors a candidate debate. Who owns the sound from it? Media correspondent David Folkenflik joins the show to discuss that. And a former ambassador and advisor to President Obama says fear of creating another Iraq may have influenced the president's policy in Syria too much. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. It's mostly sunny right now in Phoenix and 68 degrees at 11:45.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Many of us have direct or indirect experience with eating disorders, and we're most familiar with bulimia and anorexia. But more research is revealing additional disorders. One, orthorexia nervosa, involves a rigid commitment to eating healthfully to the extent that the focus shifts to food quality and purity and a different kind of self-punishment. Joining me to talk about eating disorders more generally is Dr. Gail Masterson, psychiatrist at Sierra Tucson, a treatment and recovery center. Dr. Masterson, good morning.
Good morning.
So for some people,
you?
I'm great. Thanks for being with us. So for some people, sure. Diet is a bad word. Do people focus too much on the concept of dieting, regardless of what that may mean in a general sense?
I think so. I think that's a place where some of it can start for some people. But oftentimes there are issues or patterns in interpersonal relationships that kind of precede that preoccupation with body image, weight, and then lead to changes in eating behaviors.
I wonder, not to simplify it too much, but when it comes to eating disorders, how much of it has to do with nature, how much with nurture, how much of it is that someone may be born with the ability or the tendency to go that direction, and in other cases, we're sort of seeing what society expects from people.
Wow. You know, I think it's really, unfortunately, a combination of all of that. So piecing it apart from the nature standpoint, you know, I think all human beings have different body shapes. You know, there's some classifications of endomorph, ectomorph, mesomorph, things like that. But that there may be some people who may have a higher likelihood of easily putting on weight or having difficulty getting off of weight. So from a genetic or biologic standpoint, there can be that kind of predisposition. And then one of the ways that we tend to focus on eating disorder treatment is looking at early childhood development, early childhood, early relationship issues, things called attachment, the ways in which children learn to navigate and negotiate relationships. And that's typically where the seeds of eating disorders start. And, you know, our earliest experiences are being in relationship with a primary caregiver and needing to be fed, needing to feed and eat to survive. So I think when there is some disruption in how strong or how healthy that attachment is with primary relationships, that can also contribute to how someone continues to develop throughout their life and engage in relationships with other people and contribute to how somebody turns to food and their relationship with food in different ways, but often in eating disorders in unhealthy ways. And then there was another piece. Oh, society, culture. You know, there's such an unhealthy focus in media and society on body shapes and weights that are virtually not realistically attainable for most people. And then that gets glamorized and sets a whole nother standard for people that already have that kind of predisposition or seeds already there to develop into a full eating disorder.
And Doctor, there's been a dramatic movement related to body positivity, and I wonder, how do you think that's impacted classification when it comes to relatively new eating disorder names, like orthorexia, which has come up with people, as I said in the introduction, folks who may in fact think they're healthy, but then, to use the word obsess, sort of obsess about eating healthy, and that becomes, well, if I don't eat healthy all the time, then I have to punish myself in some sense.
You know, again, I think, not to avoid the question, but I think it's extremely complicated because there are cases where people are obese and for health reasons need to likely lose some weight to prevent either escalation of health issues or development of health issues. Then I think that with, again, with culture and society's emphasis on attaining a specific shape, size, weight, that there are ways that a lot of people can go to attempts to manipulate their environment, attempts to exert control over changing their body through different eating behaviors. And so I think the movement toward acceptance of everyone at any shape is wonderful because it's kind of normalizing that we should all be this supermodel body type, body shape. But again, I think that in the people that end up developing unhealthy eating behaviors, whether they are fully diagnostic for an eating disorder or not, that there is a preceding other kind of psychological issues that contribute to either that perfectionistic thinking or that obsessive thinking that can then manifest in things like orthorexia, where it's this kind of covert, you know, seemingly eating healthy, but there's an obsessive nature to it that pushes it over into not so healthy. Similarly with over-exercising or compulsive exercising, when it's in the service of attempting to control one's body and interferes with functioning in other realms of one's life, then it crosses that line from being healthy to being disruptive.
And Dr. Masterson, so many other things to discuss, but we have to end it right there. I appreciate your time. Dr. Gail Masterson is psychiatrist at Sierra Tucson, a treatment and recovery center. Thanks very much for the time. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you. You too.
The Mavericks have been lumped into a few different categories over the course of their existence. Initially, they were labeled a country band, but after reuniting in 2012 and being nominated for Grammys for Americana music, it's clear their reach is broadening. The Mavericks will be in the Valley on Saturday night at Talking Stick Resort, and their keyboardist, Jerry Dale McFadden, joins me. Jerry Dale, can we lump the Mavericks into a particular category these days?
Well, if you want just one category, I don't think it's possible, but in terms of lots of categories, I think we fit into quite a few. So, you know, it depends if you're willing to fudge a little and blur the lines.
Of course, yes.
The fans that have been with us since the early 90s recognized that we were doing something kind of different for country music at the time. And it kept morphing with each new year and each new album. Even back then, to where it was, we were slowly not trying to fit any kind of country radio mode that maybe the record company initially wanted us to do. And that when you're young and you're happy to get signed to MCA, you're like, okay, well, sure, we'll just kind of, you know, try to fit this a little bit. But eventually, the success allowed us the chance to kind of breathe into what we were doing, the stuff that we really love to do, which is kind of a mixed bag of things. I mean, we love old country music and we love old rock and roll and we love Latin music. And more recently, like we went through a ska period. So there's a bunch of songs that have kind of a ska beat to them. And, you know, so we mainly now, I think that we try to just play music that brings joy to people and makes them want to dance and have some fun. So if joy was a genre, I guess we'd be in the joy genre.
Great.
It's kind of hard to say.
You know, as an artist, though, it's got to feel good to be able to blend things together. I mean, obviously, you want to be successful. The band obviously is successful. But if we look at how the industry, at least as far as how people get their music, has changed, is this better then for the Mavericks in the sense that you're covering all sorts of different genres, that when you're not quite relying as much on radio play, you're relying more on people saying, hey, I love that CD or I want to get that download, for example. Does that free you up as artists, as a band?
I think so. I mean, I think it may help that we have a history of doing this for 25 years. So if you were a new act and doing this a broad range of kinds of styles, maybe it would be harder, but maybe not. I mean, it does seem like if you make good music, people will find it. You know, I mean, it's there's endless possibilities, and it's funny how pop music, like what is played on radio and what is popular in that sense, still kind of fits a very limited pop radio sort of style, but there's so much great music and being made now and so many ways to find it. And I think sometimes people just love to discover something new and claim it as theirs. I think sometimes even Maverick fans are kind of, they get scared a little when we were nominated for a couple of Grammys, mm-hmm. like, oh no, everybody's going to know about them, you know?
What's made the difference as far as the success of the band since you sort of reunited in the past few years? Because it seems like the last few years have been very good to the band once you reunited?
Yeah, I think it's all in our attitude. You know, in the 90s, we sold millions of records and had some success. So, and sometimes when you're young, that sort of breeds weirdness within the band. And, you know, that certain people turn into divas, and I won't name names, but probably every one of us. But, you know, and then we took a long break from each other for 8 or 9 years. And when we got back together, you know, in the 2012, I guess we started talking and doing some recording and things. But it seemed like we missed it, and we missed having, we forgot how much fun it was. And now we totally know how much fun it is. And so we take care of it a little more, and we care, because we care, I think we are just living in the moment and having such a great time. And then that the audience gets that, and they feed off of it, and we feed off of them.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Jerry Dale McFadden of the Mavericks. He'll be performing at Talking Stick Resort here in the Valley on Saturday. The concert begins at 8. Jerry Dale, you mentioned the Grammys, nominated for Best Americana Album, Best American Roots Song. So is the band being acknowledged more and praised more publicly? You mentioned how there was success in the past, but now are the fans going to say, okay, now everyone's going to jump on board because they've been nominated for Grammys? Is it vital to have that, or is it more like the cherry on top when you add the fun and the joy you were talking about before?
Well, I think it's the cherry on top in the sense we have such a fantastic, loyal fan base, and we couldn't do it without them, because we're not really about selling records. I'm not saying that we don't sell records, but you know, because of the way the industry is, it's just different these days. I mean, like, I remember when In Time came out a couple of years ago, and I think initially it had sold like 150,000 units, and I was like, oh my God, that's horrible. And then people in the industry are like, oh my God, that's amazing. You know, so it just goes to show you, like, everything has changed. It's great to get nominated for awards, and we actually won an Americana award last year for best group, which was shocking to us, because I guess we are sort of Americana, but we hadn't really thought of ourselves as Americana, although when you look at it, we're probably more Americana than any other Americana act. If you consider what America is, how it's a melting pot of all these different ethnicities and different people and cultures. And so that's kind of what the Mavericks are as well. So there, you can hear little bits of different things in every song. And that's not just because Raul is Cuban American or Eddie is Mexican American. I mean, the truth is the band started in Miami. So even our drummer, who, you know, grew up in Miami, played all kinds of Latin music, even though he's a white guy, you know. So, and I, being a piano player, have always been a fan of lots of jazz and lots of Cuban jazz. And we all have that sort of background. It's not just like one person that brings that to the table.
Do you have a preference as far as whether you're out on stage or whether you're creating with the band in a studio?
I'm a performance kind of guy. So I love to perform. I love to entertain. And I think so does everybody else in the band. I mean, we love to play music together, and when we make music in the studio, it happens fairly quickly. It's not something that we labor over specifically. I mean, we cut this last record in, you know, 5 days or something. So I mean, we know what we do, and we just go in and do it. But what we really love is to get in front of an audience and change things up and you know, just give them a show. I love a good show.
Jerry Dale McFadden of the Mavericks. The band will be performing at Talking Stick Resort on Saturday night at 8. Jerry Dale, great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on the program. And thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear my conversations with Mara Liasson on the 2016 campaign, or Dan Gilmore on Apple versus the FBI, or Michael Waldman on the fight to vote, or one of our previous programs, please go online to kjzz.org later this afternoon. Or you can download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now from Boston is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. We hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Business Bank, a CoBiz financial company, providing personal service and professional bankers for your business and personal banking needs. More online at azbizbank.com.